Hi, I'm Rachel Daniels and I am 28 years old. Today is June 7th, 2016. I am here in Omaha, Nebraska at the National Park Service Midwest Regional Office headquarters, which is also the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail headquarters. And I am here with my colleague and friend today.
And my name is Steve Forrest Russell. My age is 72, and it is June 7th, 2016, and I'm in the National Park Service Lewis and Clark headquarters here in Omaha, Nebraska, with my friend and colleague Rachel. So, Rachel, I think we should explain about our generational difference. So, we have this common interest. And we're separated by a couple of generations, and yet the generations that far apart can come together at a common interest, which is the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail.
Working for the National Park Service at the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail is, how I had the opportunity to meet you. And this, was my first professional experience right out of college at 22. And meeting you was one of the first things that I got to do working at the trail. And, being 22, it's hard to wrap your mind around how Lewis and Clark, this 200-year-old story, could consume your life today in 2016, but meeting you is one of those first experiences that I had that kind of opened that door to me and what a big impact Lewis and Clark can have still today.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I remember the first time I met you and Dan and Ryan, and there was somebody else with the group too, came to my house in Ames and wanted to talk about me getting involved as a volunteer with your organization. And you'd only been in the room about 5 minutes when Kathy and I looked at each other. Kathy's my wife. And we both had the same thought. We talked afterwards. We both had the same thought. This you're like our daughter Rebecca. So we relate. So we related to you like that. But that meeting was very instrumental in encouraging me. I was very impressed with all of the staff, all of you that had come, and it made me want to do the project that you had in mind.
Another thing from that visit that was really cool for me to see is, just coming out of school and having a background in geography and GIS, geographic information systems, and you do that as well, but seeing the format that you do your work in compared to, the current software programs like that I learned in college was just that blew me away how you were doing this amazing work on this really old software, so that was kind of a generational thing too.
It was a generational thing. Yeah, I had bought that software a long time ago, and then when the newer versions of software came along, I couldn't afford to upgrade, so I decided to stick with that. And your colleague Ryan has been very successful at taking the old stuff and putting it on your system. But that visit in the kitchen of my home led us to eventually head west and explore the Lewis and Clark Trail. I was because of our generation difference, I didn't know what to expect because I'd been out with other people where there was a large generational difference, and I had a hard time relating to sometimes when I go with people, hard time relating my background and my interest to theirs. But I had no trouble relating your interest and and the other people were there. We really hit it off. And that makes work in these kind of collaborative efforts, that makes work really much better. You get a better product and there's better enjoyment in doing the work. So I really appreciate your attitude and the attitude of your colleagues in getting us going in that area.
Do you want to talk about what the project was that you came to Steve with?
It wasn't really a specific project, that visit. It was more just to talk to Steve about him, I guess furthering your research kind of for our benefit. yeah. at that time and helping us kind of refine our geospatial data, like our geographic information systems database, and how we digitally represent the Lewis and Clark historic route. You know, use for us in our internal research in the Park Service, as well as for the public and visitors. So really, I think that's kind of a more of a big picture idea that we went to Steve with. So,
yeah, at that point, I'd been doing research on the trail for about 20 years, maybe a little bit less. But the thing that I enjoy most is the primitive camping and hiking associated with hiking the trail and exploring the trail. Being out in the mountains by yourself is a kind of a religious experience, but it's a wonderful feeling for those of us who are okay with being alone in the mountains.
I am glad I was not alone when we were in the mountains. I'm very glad you were with me, Steve.
Yeah. Most everybody expresses that. They say, well, you know, that's nice, but it's not for me. I hear that a lot.
There were a couple times when we did go out together years later, you know, after our initial meeting, that I thought, we're never going to make it out of here. There's no way. But wait, Steve's here. We're going to be fine. We will get back home.
By the time you guys came along, I'd had about 10 classes from Idaho State University where I would take approximately 15 people out in the mountains and we'd camp, car camp, and explore the Lewis and Clark Trail. So I kind of knew what to expect and was ready with whatever eventuality might happen on the trail.
Yeah. So maybe we should back up a minute and just, Steve, you know, you obviously know a lot about this, but like, how did you start? Why Lewis and Clark? What was it that caused you to dedicate so much of your life?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Rachel. I had no interest in Lewis and Clark. And then about 1984, there was something on television about Lewis and Clark. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I've heard that name, but I don't even know where they went. Were they in the South, in the West, in the East? Where were they? So I went to the Iowa State Library and found out that their journals, a copy of their journals was there, including the map volume, the Reuben Thwaites mm-hmm. map volume. When I opened that map volume and looked at the map of the Bitterroot Valley and realized that I recognized what that was, I was hooked, totally hooked. I said, I have to go out and look to see if I can find it. So the next year I went out and started exploring where I thought it was going to be in relationship to the Lewis and Clark maps. And I was doing consulting at that time, and also for my job, I was making trips to Washington, D.C., so I spent time in the National Archives mm-hmm. and trying to gather information about Western Trails and Lewis and Clark. And it kind of snowballed then, and when I found out how much I liked primitive camping and hiking, it just was a marriage made in heaven. So... Mm-hmm. So I got hooked, and I did it year after year after year after year. And I want to thank my long-suffering family for...
I was going to say, did you always go out by yourself?
I did, Wow. Rebecca, my daughter, went a few years when in her preteen years, when she was still a young lady who didn't mind not taking showers and stuff like that. But once she reached... Once she reached the teenager stage, then, you know, the thought of all of this grungy stuff didn't appeal to her anymore.
Well, wonderful. So what, I guess, would have been maybe some of the most influential people that you have come across throughout your career and your research that really helped you or maybe kind of kept you going with the research?
There were a lot of people. I've probably met, I keep a record of people that I meet, but I probably met 150 different people mm-hmm. over the course of many years in doing the work that I did. And they all had some kind of influence on me. the journals had a lot of influence on me. I kind of lived the experience through the journals. And when I would read about hailstorms and thunderstorms and rain and wet and cold, I hiked and had all of those experiences myself. So it made it really meaningful to me to do that. Gary Moulton, he was the editor of the latest edition of the journals. When I went to meet him in Omaha, I had a great meeting with Gary, and we hit it off right away. And he was very open and sharing of his information and telling me stories about everything that he had done. 20 years he had spent doing the journals, so that was an important thing. As far as out in Idaho, John Barker was a river rat on the Snake River, and John and I started hiking the trail out there. We only got to do it a little bit, but it was very important when I met John and realized that he had the resources to help me do the research. We took helicopter flights with grant money to actually look at the trail that was on the ground that we were following. So there's been many people over the year. Jim Fazio was a big influence on me because he was a president of Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation. And Jim wanted the kind of information I could provide, the nuts and bolts. You know, you've really been there, you've tripped on the rocks and slid down the ridges that where the trail goes. So those are some people. Joe Musselman, who made famous, what I think is a fabulous website about Lewis and Clark. I met Joe, we hit it off, and had a lot of good times working on Lewis and Clark. But I'll be forgetting lots and lots of people.
Lots of big names on that list. you know, you mentioned you being out on the trail yourself and experiencing, you know, like the weather and the different conditions, the way that Lewis and Clark would have. So is there like a spot that's your favorite or a place where you might have had the most powerful, like vicarious experience that you really felt like you were in their footsteps?
Yeah, there's a couple of places. The first one is when they were coming west up Lolo Creek and over the Lolo Pass. The trail separated there, and they took the fishing trail down the Lauksaw River instead of the main trail that went to the right and down and over the ridges. When I found that location and realized what it was, it was an electric shock. I mean, it felt like a revelation. I've had several of those, but my favorite one concerns Horace Axtell, who was a Nez Perce elder, and I got to know Horace real well. And Horace died here 3 or 4 years ago, but Horace and I had many good discussions. So we were at, smoking place on the Lolo Trail, and Horace was conducting a ceremony. And while Horace was doing the ceremony, a light rain came in and rained on us for a while and then left. And it was real emotional for everybody that was there. And so I saw Horace a couple of days later and we were chatting, and he said, did you see what I could do, Steve? And I said, no, what's that? And he says, I can make it rain. So that was funny. And you know, it's been fun to see Horace over the years because he's the go-to guy. He was the go-to guy for news media that wanted to interview somebody about tribal matters. So you'll see his face in a lot of places.
So what is the significance of Smoking Place for Lewis and Clark? I know that we desperately wanted to get there on our trip, but we were snowed out.
Yeah. Well, Smoking Place was one of the more identifiable locations through the mountains. So that and the sinkhole were two of the places that everyone could find, you know, in exploring by themselves, they could find those two locations. But I'd been there with Horace for ceremonies, and there was a grave there, and but in the Lewis and Clark story, it was they stopped there to look eastward at the tremendous amount of mountains they still had to go through, but they were in good shape because, you know, it was late spring, early summer. And they also had an Nez Perce guide, so it wasn't an insecure. They looked upon it as a secure experience rather than an insecure. But it's tremendous viewing.
Good. So speaking of all those mountains, have you had any really close calls or close scary encounters with wildlife?
Well, yeah.
That you live to tell about?
I live to tell. Actually, I have had such great experiences, and I never suffered a serious injury. I never broke anything or tore anything, but I had three cougar encounters, and my first encounter, they looked really big to me.
Oh, my gosh.
And this one was only about, I would guess, maybe 60 feet away. And it was looking at me with no fear.
Oh, my gosh.
And I do carry a pistol and pepper spray for protection.
Did you on our trip?
Did I? Yeah, I did.
You did?
did what?
You carry a pistol and pepper spray?
Well, I thought I did.
Did you? I don't think you disclosed that to us.
Oh, I didn't? Okay, well, I did.
So I was a lot safer the entire time than I thought.
Than you thought you
well,
were,
I could have relaxed a little bit if you had told me.
I didn't carry pepper spray
Well, we were ready with our bear spray training.
Yeah. I didn't carry pepper spray until I had a grizzly encounter. And after the grizzly encounter, I realized that I would be so nervous trying to shoot my pistol that I was better off with bear spray. And the bear would be better off, too. So between the two of us. And the encounter was, I was going down a ridge, he was coming up. The brush was really thick, and I came into a really small clearing, and he came out of the brush, and we both saw each other at the same instant, and then he dived into the brush and started bellowing. This is the best way I could, kind of a bark growl. And that sound would go clear across Hungry Creek Canyon, maybe a mile, and come back. That's how loud he was. I could hear his bellowing all the way across that canyon. After about 20 minutes, when the adrenaline started going down for him and for me, then he started moving off. He started skirting around the side of the ridge to get away from me. And normally, they're not afraid, but in this case, he had been bear collared and captured in a culvert trap. So he didn't want to have another experience with somebody that smelled like me. The wind was going down ridge at that time.
Oh my gosh.
And lots of black bear.
You know, one of the most uncomfortable things you probably said to us before our trip into the woods was that we might not see a cougar, but we would be stalked by a cougar when we were out there.
Yeah.
So that was a little unsettling.
Yeah, there in recent years there's been enough cougar where we went that they will stalk particularly the hunters and the outfitters report every year that they get stalked by cougar. There's just enough of them. A lot of it's curiosity. They're not really looking for food. They could be looking for food. But when I've been stalked, I can hear them in the brush traveling with me, but they stay out of sight.
No thanks. Do you have any plans to get back out on the trail anytime soon? I know you've already probably seen most of it.
I have. What I'm trying to do this summer is go to the Great Basin of the Western U.S., which is the area between Salt Lake City and Carson City, Nevada. That's a huge desert area, and there were pioneering trails put in there in the 1850s. So my plan is to go out and explore that area for the summer, and then I will be following segments of the Oregon Trail. One of my friends, Tony Verloni, had an accident last Christmas and died, so I can't do any more exploring with Tony, but I still want to go out and do what we probably would have done had he still been alive.
Sure. So you have other, interests, obviously, then, besides just the Lewis and Clark story and the Lewis and Clark Trail. So
I do.
This is clearly ingrained in your being. Like, was there something as a child or the way that you grew up or were raised that kind of led you in this direction in general?
There was. As a small child, and by small I mean 8 years old, I was fascinated with old trails that went through the woods. And so we lived at a place called Locksaw Lodge in Idaho. And I was out exploring any kind of game trail or Forest Service trail or anything I could when I was very young. And I always had a fascination with trails. But I'd lived on the Lewis and Clark Trail at Locksaw Lodge. And my parents grew up, and I lived for a while in Weipe, Idaho, when I was tiny. And that was on the trail. The trail goes across the front lawn of the Locksaw Lodge. And then I lived at Stevensville, Montana, where the Lewis and Clark Trail also came by, and they had a campsite that was about a half a mile from where I lived. So, but I didn't realize that until I looked at those maps and started going to the National Archives.
So when you were actually a kid living there, you had no idea that the trail was in your front yard?
No, nobody ever talked about it. No, nobody said a word. No.
Oh, my goodness.
In fact, the Forest Service guys, when they'd come up to have a few beers at Locksaw Lodge, they were coming up on the Lewis and Clark Trail.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know the route down there.
Yeah.
Their location there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, very good.
So was hiking and exploring always part of your career path, or what did you do before Lewis and Clark?
Actually, I wanted to be an engineer all my life. When I was 6 years old, I took a bunch of copper wire and a cardboard box and tried to build a radio. And my theory was if I did enough experimenting with it, it would work. But, of course, a cardboard box and wire doesn't make a radio. So, but I always wanted that. I majored in electrical engineering in college, and I got my dream job working for Collins Radio Corporation, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. After graduation.
Born in Cedar Rapids.
yes. So, your hometown.
That's right. Look at all these connections we have.
And then what happened after that job?
Well,
during that job?
Then I went to graduate school and got a PhD, and then I went back and worked for them on the GPS program in the late 70s. And I'm one of the graybeards of the GPS program. It started in the fall of 75, and I joined them in March of 76. So I had played an instrumental role in getting the military GPS up and working properly. And I did the first civilian GPS contract with General Motors. I was a program manager for that. And they wanted to put them in Cadillacs, the GPS units in Cadillacs. And that was in 1979, which was really a long time ago. But then I left to go to work for another aerospace company. And then in 84... I went to Iowa State University and joined the faculty there and then retired from Iowa State.
Wow. And then your Lewis and Clark work really ramped up.
Yeah, the Lewis and Clark work started when I was at Iowa State. But when I retired, I've always been a trumpet player. So when I retired, I started playing Dixieland jazz. And I taught myself to compose and to do chord structures. And then I decided I would play the baritone and the trombone, so I picked those up. So my career in retirement has been a lot of music.
It's been musical, yeah.
Yeah, which is what I wanted.
Oh, great. Well, we sure enjoy it when you get the trumpet out for us. Well, kind of going back to your GPS work a little bit, just thinking back on your career and your research, specifically in historic trails, what has kind of been the most advantageous technological advancement that you have seen and that's helped you in your work?
Well, before computer GIS, I had paper maps and was drawing with ink on paper maps. I made paper maps. I used USGS topo quads to locate the trails. So the co-development, the things that really made life a lot better for my work was the advent of low-cost handheld GPS units, and also the ArcView 3.2 GIS program, which now I could actually document those and print out documents. Sure. And that was a really huge step forward for me.
Sure. I was definitely impressed in the field the way that you used your, I don't even know what model, Garmin
it's
that you
Garmin
had.
It's a Garmin 12XL.
That had no topography, nothing. I had no idea where we were. And yeah. I remember yours, we went, as the Park Service staff, we went equipped with, you know, the latest, greatest new Garmin handheld GPS units. We were lost. I believe your unit, the batteries died, so we ended up taking the batteries out of the new ones to put in yours so that we could get out of there.
Well, the reason why I used the 12XL all those years is because it could receive and calculate a position in difficult terrain where other units I'd try had not. So that's why I stayed with it.
Well, don't fix it if it isn't broke, right?
No, I bought two more on eBay. I have a lifetime supply of 12XLs.
Oh, man. So if you had one hope, I guess, for the future of the Lewis and Clark Trail, you know, for generations to come, what would that be?
Well, I hope future generations maintain an interest in it, and I hope that future generations will help preserve it, because there's always development pressure, there's always things that happen, and the experience that I've had can't be had by anyone else now, because some of that trail has already disappeared mm-hmm. that I was able to experience, and I'm just hoping that enough of it is preserved so that people are able to enjoy the experience I did, the actual, you know, where they went, actually where they camped, and, you know, the weather that they experienced.
Why is it important for them to have an interest in it?
Well, I believe that everyone's life is enriched by more and varied experiences and more and varied interests. In the case of my daughters, I've tried to give them every kind of experience. Whatever they expressed any interest in, you know, try to do it in their sports or in any areas that they were interested in, the music. And I think people live richer lives when that happens. And if they have something that's authentic, if it's not abstracted to the point that they have to look at a picture or pull up a computer screen and look at it, if they can actually smell and taste and touch the actual thing, that enriches their life experience.
Sure. Are you planning on exposing your grandchildren to Lewis and Clark? Speaking of keeping this going.
As soon as I can,
as soon
yeah.
As you can.
I have one that's 7 now who might be a candidate for going out. Yeah.
Wonderful.
And what do you hope for the future of your career?
Well, I'm still going to play music. I have played, I think, 3 or 4 times this past week, and I'll continue doing that. And I wanna keep working with the Park Service because they have a good handle and authority to help this preservation interpretation mm-hmm. thing that goes on, and I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And I would like you guys to have all the information I've got so that will help you do it.
Well, it's absolutely been beneficial partnering with you and tapping into your knowledge and research and that kind of thing. And as I think you know, many of us on staff have musical talent. So if we're not meeting on Lewis and Clark Matters, we can meet up for a jam session.
Okay.
Is there one thing in particular that you have learned from Steve or have become interested in because of Steve?
Oh my gosh. Well, I guess I will just say Steve has given me my first and only real life hiking in the woods experience so far. So for that, I will forever be grateful to Steve. That was really, truly a once in a lifetime experience. And unless it is with Steve again someday, I really don't see how I would have another opportunity again to be out in the field in that way with somebody that had this knowledge. And, you know, we went out there to, of course, learn from Steve and look at his methodology and that kind of thing, which was wonderful. But I'm going to be honest with you. That's just way too much to try and comprehend and learn in a week, you know.
Yeah.
So I really walked away with a once-in-a-lifetime experience. But could I articulate your methodology to someone else or replicate it? Absolutely not. Like, it's truly incredible. So for that, I thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. That was amazing.
Is there anything else that you guys would like to say? We have a few more minutes if you'd like to use it.
What are your plans for continuing with Lewis and Clark?
What are my plans? Well, I just had my 6-year anniversary with the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail this month, as well as, you know, the Park Service as well. This has been my one and only job out of college, and I'm very grateful that I was able or am able, you know, to use my education and my degree and my job. And you know, for now, I hope to be at Lewis and Clark. I, you know, coming into this, I thought it sounded like kind of a strange job, I guess, you know, working for Lewis and Clark, making a career out of, you know, such an old story out of history. But it's been truly amazing, all the people I've got to meet and my coworkers, just how relevant it still is and how important it still is. So for now, I'm just excited to be growing my career at the Park Service and at Lewis and Clark. You know, I learn something new every day about Lewis and Clark and the story. So I'm just excited to keep that going.
When you first accepted the job, did you think this seemed kind of narrow? Did it seem like real narrow? And when did you experience the feeling that, oh, there's a lot more behind the curtain than I thought there was?
Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah. Yeah, like I said, it just seemed like kind of a bizarre occupation, I guess. Not working for the Park Service, but the fact that there was this Lewis and Clark entity, like this whole staff and team of people who are dedicating their career to Lewis and Clark. It was almost like how is their work there? How is that possible? So, you know, right away, I got to get on the road with my coworkers and take a couple trips, meet folks like yourself. And it became clear pretty quickly how big this thing is and how important it is. So really my first year, just all the opportunities I had getting to travel and meet historians and researchers like yourself was really eye-opening.
I have a lot of respect for women who can juggle a job and now three kids. tell us a little bit about how that works.
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know yet, Steve. I'm still currently at home for a couple more weeks with my youngest. I have a 3-year-old, a 1-year-old, and a 2-month-old. So I think it's important. Like, I want my kids to see their mom having a successful career with something that I am passionate about and truly love. And I'll obviously be getting them involved in the Park Service and conservation as soon as I can. And of course, they will know more about Lewis and Clark than any other fourth grader in their class, that's for sure.
Well, they'll teach the class, huh?
You know, you kind of just do it. You have to. And I love it. I wouldn't change it.
Do you think you'll ever get them out on the trail hiking?
Oh, gosh. Well, if you were going to go with us, you know, I'm kind of like that daughter of yours. I need the Holiday Inn. You know that. But you know, I would love to, but I really feel like I wouldn't know where to start. Like it would definitely take some trip planning.
It impresses me that you have the opportunity to share your work with your children. And I always think that that's very important thing. You know, what does mom do? What's mom passionate about? In my job, so much of my job was not being able to communicate with my family what I was doing. And sure. I think it's really great that you're going to have that opportunity. Right. Your kids are really going to know what mom did.
I hope so. You know, my husband and I both, we don't have backgrounds where, like, we didn't grow up traveling to national parks and hiking and doing things like that. So it's kind of, an unlikely career path for me, but I am so thankful that I found it and I'm truly passionate about it. So we're going to do the best we can for them.
That's great.
Yeah. Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Goodbye, all.
I'll see you in Ames for some barbecue.
See you in Ames for some barbecue, yes.